Hi, I'm Kumi Taguchi and I host a TV show in Australia called Insight, which is unlike any other.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Every week in the same room, we have dozens of guests telling their stories about one shared issue.
There definitely was 3 people in my marriage.
I started an affair with this man.
From sex and relationships to health, wealth and grief.
Dad, there's been a shooting at the elementary school.
And there's always a guest whose story stays with me.
I actually had guilt for not killing someone.
And I'm left feeling there's so much more I want to ask them. I often wonder, where are they now? So that's what I do here. I go back and I dig a little deeper. This is Insightful. In this episode, I catch up with Melissa Kang. You might not know that name, but if you grew up in Australia in the 80s or 90s, you'll know her other name, Dolly Doctor.
Dolly Doctor was it. Once a month, Dolly would come out and we would all pounce on it.
It was the Holy Grail. We would gather. Someone would always get a copy and we would gather around it, and someone would have it hiding in their bag and it would get passed around. And, you know, I think we'd all be quite bravado and we'd giggle and we'd laugh and we'd go, oh, if you do that, or who's silly enough to do that? Inside probably going, oh, wow, didn't know that.
Yes, Melissa Kang was the real-life doctor. She answered all those awkward teenage questions for the popular monthly magazine Dolly. She was the adolescent agony aunt. I met Melissa on an episode of Insight about advice.
Melissa, you're a GP and you were Dolly Doctor.
For 23 years, Melissa answered hundreds upon hundreds of readers' questions about sex and periods, dating and boobs. The time with Melissa in the studio felt just too short. I kept looking at her and thinking, wow, she is that doctor. And I wanted to know so much more. How she got the job, what her upbringing was like. I'm half Japanese, half Australian, and I saw a little bit of me in her face. She too is mixed race, and I was so keen to tap into that as well. Before Melissa came in for her interview, she told us that as a child, her family often played table tennis. In fact, her dad made the family's table tennis table. How's that for alliteration? We have a table here at work. Well, it's kind of like a makeshift one, a board resting on top of an old pool table, but it does the job. And I had to have a hit with her.
My father was the champion.
Was he?
Yeah. He was the champion of the RSL club. And,
like literal champion?
Yeah. Until he ruptured his Achilles tendon one day. But he did teach my brother and me to play ping pong. When we moved to Australia and he built this big ping pong table, we played every Friday night with our neighbours.
It's actually quite fun.
Yeah.
It kind of takes you into the moment.
Yeah.
Melissa, it's so great to see you again.
And you too, Kumi.
I do want to start with Dolly Doctor. How did you get the job?
I was in the right place at the right time. It was complete serendipity. I was working in adolescent medicine in a department, so I was surrounded by health professionals who were very specialised in adolescent medicine, but there was a GP who had the gig. She was writing for Dolly Doctor, and I said, how on earth did you get that? Do let me know. She actually consulted with me, or we answered some questions together a couple of times. And then at one point, after a few months, she said, look, I'm going to stop doing this now. Are you interested? And I said, sure. And that's really how it started. So it was literally just meeting this person because our paths crossed for a few months of a year.
So this was in the 80s?
No, this was 1993.
For our listeners, just how big was Dolly Doctor and the Dolly magazine?
The magazine launched in 1970, so way before then. I was still a child then and living overseas, but I certainly read Dolly magazine as a teenager. By the time I took over the reins as the consultant behind Dolly Doctor, the readership was over 500,000 and very broad circulation. It also had the monopoly in Australia and New Zealand as the only teenage girls magazine at that time.
You received letters about just about everything, I imagine. What did a lot of those questions tell you about adolescent Australians in the 90s?
You know that it didn't really hadn't changed since I was an adolescent in the 80s or 70s. I think that the overwhelming angst in those letters, this sort of desperation, this need for an urgent answer to their questions was something that probably we could all relate to. And certainly the words on the page or in the letters would always take me back really to my own adolescence. They were mostly questions about what was happening to their bodies. So the physical changes of puberty and the emotional sort of angst that accompanied that. That would have been the majority of letters.
How did the process actually work? So you would receive a letter in the office, read it, decide which ones to reply to?
It was an editor or sub-editor who would vet the questions, read them all and choose the ones to be answered. They would select about 5 questions a month and back in those days fax them to me. It took about 10 years, I think, before email came into use in the office at Dolly. There was a period of time when I asked if I could have a look at the range of letters that they were getting, because I'd get 5 a month. That's all I could see. And after a few months, I said, can I see all of them? And this is how it all started. They mailed me about 300 letters.
Wow.
And I pored over them and I said, wow, this is amazing. I have a collection at home of all these letters that they just kept mailing me. That process of reading all the letters made me say, look, I think it would be good to include some letters on these topics or those topics. But I didn't really need to do that. The sub-editors were really good at getting the range and breadth of topics and making sure that they were all covered in some way or other.
It would be interesting, though, with those 300, you really get a sense of what people are talking about, worried about.
Exactly. And a few years later, I looked at maybe 600. And 10 years after that, I looked at 1,000 emails. So I actually did do a couple of more scientific or rigorous analyses to look at the breadth of topics and even published a couple of research papers on that topic, which is why I know that the majority were about the physical changes of puberty. The next biggest topic would have been sexuality and sex and emerging sexual feelings and relationships.
Do you think there would be different topics today?
I think there has been a shift in terms of the focus on mental health. There has been an analysis done, not by me, on the published questions and answers for Dolly Doctor 10 years apart. And there was a shift from talking about sex and relationships through to an emphasis more on mental health. So I think that is consistent with what we know young people, adolescents and young adults are experiencing in terms of the burden of ill health.
Going back to your letter process, I'm just fascinated with the time it would have taken. The letter comes by fax, you reply. How long then was it published in the magazine? And so for that young girl, how long would it take for her to potentially read that?
Well, it would be 3 months, which, as you may recall, is a very long time when you're 11 or 12 or 13.
Really long.
That's right. And the topics were so similar, I think, that it resolved some of those concerns.
Everyone would be reading the magazine, not so much, I would imagine, to see if their own letter was published, but just to read what other teenagers were concerned about and feel not alone.
I think as humans, we're all a little bit naturally voyeuristic and we love reading personal stories. And Dolly Doctor, when I read the magazine, was very much talking to my experience. That's why it was probably so popular and still remembered so fondly, because it spoke to all of those things that we worried about as we were growing up.
We tend to think that the readership would be young women, but you did have quite a high percentage of young men reading Dolly Doctor too. Did that surprise you?
Not really. The readership was possibly even 20% male. Made sense to me given I had brothers, and I imagine that they also sometimes picked up the magazine if it was at home, and it's what I hear from other men who tell me that their sisters had the magazine. I don't know that they would have gone and bought it themselves. We also got questions from boys, not very many, but there was a period of time where I convinced the editor to publish the boys' questions. And so we did. There was a period when there was maybe even 15 questions a month, which included 5 boys' questions. And that was fantastic, I thought.
It really hits me just how bold the Dolly Doctor column was at the time. It was quite groundbreaking in the way it gave a platform to all those young voices, predominantly young women, way before social media. Did you ever feel a sense of responsibility to your readers, thinking, I'm providing this information, I hope I get it right, I hope it does the right thing for them?
I was always so pedantic about that. I can say after 23 years, even though the topics repeated and repeated and repeated, I never wrote the same answer twice. I would often ring up specialists, sometimes with a dermatologist, often a dentist, and a lot with colleagues who were specialists in puberty. So endocrinologists who were specialising in adolescent medicine were also people I consulted with quite a bit, or I'd read up textbooks or articles that were relevant. And then condensing that down to maybe 200 words would always be quite tricky, depending on the question.
Do you feel like your voice could be more intimate in a way in a letter than, say, if you're sitting consulting with an adolescent in a room? Was there something about the medium that allowed you to be a different kind of consultant, different kind of GP?
Having access to all of those letters and questions made me a better GP. And I suppose that's the key thing that I've tried to take away and sort of spread the word about when I train medical students or GPs, is that there is so much underneath the surface that may not ever cause any grief, but to really allow the young person to know that we're trying to understand what's going on for them as best we can and as much as they want us to. It's useful to know that hundreds and thousands of adolescent girls have written in to a magazine around the country about these sorts of issues, and to bring them up if it's appropriate. So I might bring up with a patient the fact that a lot of people of this age might be worried about when their periods are going to start. Things like that. So giving information and a bit of education maybe ahead of time. I think that's probably what I learned. Writing is a very intimate activity, and I think that's why writing to Dolly Magazine was so important to so many young people, because you could really bare your soul in words that you wouldn't be comfortable doing face-to-face with a doctor. And I think the response to that is also very intimate. But it's a different experience to when I see a patient one-on-one. That can be a very, very deeply personal exchange for the young person as well. And I feel very privileged when they do open up to me.
It was so easy chatting with Melissa, and I can see why she would be such a great GP and so good with adolescents. I wondered what her growing up years were like. Was she one of those kids whose parents were just really open about life and that's where she got it from? What was your own childhood and adolescence like, Melissa?
My childhood was spent in Malaysia, in a town called Kota Baru, which was the capital town of an eastern state called Kelantan, which is a state in the peninsula that borders with Thailand. So my father was born there, and he's of Chinese heritage, but never knew really much about his heritage, other than ancestors probably migrated 4 or 5 generations before him. I was born in Australia, but we moved back to Malaysia when I was about 1.
So your mum was Australian?
My mother was an Anglo-Australian. And so my childhood was spent in Malaysia till I was 10, and then my adolescence here in Sydney.
Do you remember much about those Malaysian years?
Yeah, very strongly. I think they were very formative as they are. I went to preschool there. I went to primary school for about 2.5 years, and then I got scared of my teacher, so I asked my parents if I could leave school, so they said all right. So I left school when I was about 8.
Really?
I did.
And you stayed at home?
I stayed at home. I was always enrolled in the distance education. It was then called the Correspondence School in New South Wales. I was doing lessons at home all the time anyway, to do this sort of Australian syllabus or the New South Wales syllabus while going to school in Malaysia. So leaving school just meant I didn't physically go to the Malay school at the time.
I see. What got you scared?
Well, she was very strict. It was very strict in Malaysia. They were all very strict. And I don't know, nothing particularly happened. There was no event, but I just sort of thought, oh, do I really have to keep going to school? And they said, no, okay. The deal was that Dad said to my brother and me, I want you to go to Chinese school, which he had already tried and failed. We had gone once, I think. So I said, okay, I'll go to Chinese school. I would say anything really. And so I think I went once or twice more. But poor Dad, none of us ever learnt to speak Mandarin. He couldn't speak Mandarin. He spoke a language called Hokkien, and that's the only Chinese language he spoke. He never could read or write Chinese, and he didn't speak Mandarin. I think he always hoped one of his children would.
When you moved back to Australia, you were in your teens. What was it like transitioning to life back here again?
It was a huge culture shock. So I'd been at school in Malaysia where the class sizes were huge, so 50, 55 students in a class, and very strict, very disciplined. Not as in punishment or anything, but just very strict, and you just kept quiet unless spoken to. I arrived at school in Sydney and no one wore the school uniform, and everyone was a bit rough and tumble, and I was equally terrified, this time by everybody, not just the teachers. For a while, it took me about 6 months or so to start to settle down and feel a bit more comfortable.
Did you feel like you fitted in terms of your mixed race heritage?
Not at all. The high school I went to, I think there were fewer than five students who had any Asian heritage. One of them was also Eurasian like me. I had an Anglo-Australian mother as well and a Hong Kong Chinese, I think, father. And we became very good friends, and she had a brother and a cousin at the school, but I think we were the only, and my brother, I think we were the only Asians in the school.
Did you feel sort of on the outer, or did you just feel different?
I felt very conspicuous and didn't want to be. So I still had an accent until about the middle of year seven. I think this is natural, that if you migrate before puberty, your accent becomes the new host country's accent, which mine did, but I also was keen to lose it fairly quickly as well.
So you tried to sound more Aussie?
Yes.
How would you do that?
Not very well, I don't think. There were certain words I pronounced that people would laugh at me, so I'd always try and change them.
Were there moments at high school where you started to feel like you'd found something that was you, your thing?
I think at high school, the group of friends I was with, we were the really nerdy group, and I think we found a lot of safety and companionship in that. We just sort of put our heads down and studied, and that felt really nice going through high school with that sort of group.
And what was your relationship like with your mum and dad, especially as you became a young woman venturing out into the world?
It was fine up until my later adolescence. I'd always been very close to my dad. There was just something that gelled between us from very young childhood. When we moved to Australia, I became much closer to my mum, which I think is probably what happens for a lot of adolescent girls. She was at that time a stay-at-home mum. I would like to be her little helper, cooking and ironing and those sorts of things, very female things. So I was very close to her during my early adolescence. And then as I got towards the end of high school and certainly university, things started to fall apart a little bit because of my interest in boys and relationships and growing up. And my father found that very challenging. I kind of wish I could go back and ask him about that. He died several years ago now, but it was one thing I tried to talk about when I was an adult. But I don't know if it's because I was the oldest daughter that it was difficult for him as a parent, as a father. The main message I got from all of this was there was a real double standard. So the kinds of messages I got about being a young woman interested in relationships was very different, and particularly around sex. What that would label me as was very different to the messages that I believed my brothers were getting.
You studied medicine.
Yes.
Your dad did as well. Was it ever your plan to follow in his footsteps?
Absolutely not. The opposite, in fact. So Dad was a very old school, traditional family GP, but I chose medicine, I'm sure, because I knew it would make him happy.
Yeah, wow.
I wanted to work with people. Don't get me wrong. I really wanted a profession where I would interact with people, get to understand them. And I came across this new specialty in Australia called adolescent medicine through a lecture. It really spoke to me because it was about the young person at the heart of it, their families, their school and their peers, the importance of education and information. And I guess it just spoke to all the things that I felt I missed out on, perhaps, in terms of learning about my body and relationships and growing up.
You went on to become a mum yourself. You have a son and three daughters.
Yes.
Your professional knowledge surely would have been amazing for them. Did they have a different childhood, I guess, to the one you had?
I really wanted to give them the skills and the complete acceptance that it was all right to ask questions. I hope that was very different for them. You know, my mother was so not able to talk to us about puberty or sex or any of those things. And I didn't want to be like that because I feel like it was such a taboo area growing up and I wanted it not to be taboo for my children. My third of the four children was born when I took over Dolly Doctor. So they really grew up with me doing that role. And I was very strict. They weren't allowed to open any of my Dolly magazines until I determined that they were of an appropriate age. But I suspect they probably snuck a look from time to time.
Of course. Yeah. I love the idea that we can break the cycle, that we can change a family pattern and do things differently for our kids. What was it like to break that cycle in a way of being really honest with your children and having those conversations?
I did find it awkward, and I suppose it was just, well, I'm not, you know, I will blame my parents. I think it was just something when that's been your experience growing up, you're not quite sure how to broach it. I can do it in a consulting room as a professional. That's really easy. But with one's own children, it is. It's an awkward conversation. So I wouldn't say it came absolutely naturally. I certainly was very happy to give them information and to ask them questions about and to sort of predict or anticipate what might be going on.
And you were doing this as a single parent?
I was a single parent for most of their lives, yeah.
Was that a pressure on you, or you seemed to juggle it really well?
Look, I think their father was always involved and we had a good routine. The logistics of it were fairly straightforward. Well, they were very straightforward, really. So that made a big difference. I think it worked really well. They were really wonderful years of my life.
What did you love about them?
I absolutely loved raising these children. It was just so lovely. But I also needed a professional life and a life alongside that. And so I still feel very lucky that I got all of that.
When Melissa was on the show, she spoke a little bit about menopause and said it was like going through puberty again, just all the unknowns. We didn't have time then to go into it, but I wondered how she navigated it all herself.
I could certainly easily look stuff up myself and understand medically what was going on, physiologically what was going on. But I think for me, the shock was that it really was like going through puberty again. Maybe not quite as dreadful because I think at, you know, 11, 12, 13, you're just so self-conscious,
yes,
which I wasn't as a middle-aged woman, not in the same way anyway. For me, it was not a terrible ordeal. I mean, I have friends and colleagues where menopause has really been very fraught and very difficult. So for me, it was okay, but it did really feel like I had no control over my body no matter what I did.
It feels like menopause is having a bit of a moment in the spotlight.
It just speaks to how women and what their bodies go through, whether it's pregnancy or post-childbirth or puberty or menopause or even old post-menopause, older age, sexuality, all those things that happen to women do, they either get pushed down or they get trivialised or dismissed. I think that's the problem. And I think it's really great that menopause has suddenly reached the spotlight and isn't being ridiculed or dismissed. There is certainly a lot more that needs to be said about menopause, written about menopause, and just for people to have conversations, and not just women, but men as well, to sort of, same as Dolly Doctor for girls was really important for boys to know and vice versa, I think it's the same as people go through menopause.
When you were in the studio, a couple of the guests were so excited to meet you and know that you were Dolly Doctor. Have you had experiences like that before where people have just blown away that there was you and you might have written to them?
I realise the impact that Ollie Doctor had. I just feel I can't take credit. I mean, I took my work and my role very seriously, and I'm happy to take credit for that. And I want people to know that I was very thorough and, you know, felt this great sense of responsibility. But I can't take credit for the fact that it was something that right from the get-go, the editors felt were really important. They took that part of the magazine really, really seriously, and they made sure that it was really authentic and really well researched. And that's why it has such cultural and historical value for all the people that engaged with it at the time.
Melissa, it's so lovely to see you again. Thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure and delight.
You've been listening to Insightful, an 8-part series from SBS, recorded in Sydney, Australia, on the land of the Gadigal people. Insightful is produced by Felicity Davey, Cassandra Allen and Kate Harassi, and edited by Maddox Foster. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay tuned for more. Until next time, I'm Kumi Taguchi. Thanks so much for your company.